Hi everyone, welcome to the Talking Split podcast. I'm Rob Calder. With me I have Mike Zeppel and Justin Schuller, the high performance coaches for Metro and Country. Welcome guys.
Robbie.
G'day.
We are currently sweltering at the State Basketball Centre as the aircon has gone out. It is cooking in here, so this might be fairly short and sweet. We'll see how this plays out.
Something tells me not.
Probably not. Thanks for joining us for the podcast. You can get this on iTunes and via the Basketball Victoria website. If you haven't already, please do leave a rating and a review for us. Helps us to know how we're going. You can also get all our email addresses off the Basketball Victoria website or reach out on Twitter, which we've had a couple of coaches do already.
Great interaction.
With the hashtag TalkingSplit, and we'll pick up all your questions from there. It's been fantastic. I've had a couple of topics sent in. One of the topics we've had is from Coach Dean talking about game strategy. And this will differ a lot for different coaches, and obviously a lot of this is personnel driven as well. So all we're going to really do is throw in a couple of different scenarios and just talk through what we would be looking for in a game. So we're going to assume ball gets tipped and we're off. We're not going to talk about the pre-game, the prep in terms of what you've done that week either. It is literally just the game itself.
Stuff's happening.
Yeah, and in all hypothetical worlds, we can't be wrong. So from our end, this is always going to play out perfectly and life is going to be good. But obviously, we take no responsibility if you try any of this and lose. That's not our fault. That's on you guys. So probably the first thing we look at is scoring runs. I feel like there have been plenty of times where I've opened up games and I've gone down 6-0 straight away. And then you have that moral dilemma in your head. And I know some coaches have like a little button they almost push in terms of if they get scored on 3 times in a row, they're blowing a timeout regardless. At what point do you make changes with this? Because I know other coaches that have sat there and said, well, you know what? We've been scored on 3 times in a row. We've had 3 great looks down the other end. We just missed. Do you need to call that timeout to settle your players down? What are your thoughts of that?
Well, I'll dive in straight away. I had this example a few times in Siebel last year where in reviewing the game afterwards, didn't call the timeout when my rule is run a 7. So if it gets to 7, that's a review point, or was a review point with the staff to go, where do we feel we're at now?
So when you say run a 7, like 7-point margin?
7-0.
Yep.
So they've gone on a 7-0 scoring run to us. So that was always a review point of, is our process good? Are we getting good looks and it's just not dropping, or are we really, we're just missing the mark and we've got to ping it? After last year, and we had a kind of a challenging year, but the games that we had an opportunity to win, we literally lost in that first quarter by not blowing that timeout. So Ian Stack was my assistant, long-time mentor for me, and he kept saying, it's the first quarter. And to me, that's really changed my philosophy on it, that I used to want to try and save that timeout for the second quarter in case we needed to and really control the game that way. Mm. Now I'm of the belief that, if someone's gone 7-0 on you, that's at a higher level enough to win a ball game. So now it's just automatic. The assistant has the license to call that timeout.
Yeah.
And that's a change in my philosophy.
I was just about to say that. To take the emotion out of it, and I did a similar thing at Werribee last year, to take the emotion out of it, the assistant's job was 7-0, tell the bench we need the next timeout.
Yeah.
So you are removed from the responsibility of having it. You can't make any emotional decision. No, we might get a bucket hit. It might, straighten itself up. No, 7-0. That's not a bad idea. Not a bad idea. And you can lose the game in the first 6 or 7 minutes, even if you are getting good shots. Because in the timeout, you can say, hey, we're getting good looks. Draw something up to get another good look. Because a lot of the time, scoreboard pressure builds.
Yeah.
If you've got experienced guys, older guys or girls on your team, you might be able to weather that storm. If you've got some young athletes and you're down 9-0 with 4.5 minutes to go in the first quarter, that can quickly become 15-1, 15-2.
The other challenge with that is usually when it's 7-0, the game isn't having any stoppages for you, so you don't even have a chance to talk to your point guard, get them to huddle and converse. So, in reviewing all that, that was my nut. That's hard and fast. That's how we're operating.
So, just say you miss that timeout for argument's sake, and you get a bucket. Are you still blowing that timeout next chance you get?
Hindsight's a really beautiful thing, Robbie. Maybe not.
Yeah.
You can communicate it with the bench and say, no, don't worry about it. If that's the way you now feel. If it now becomes 7-3 and you get a stop and becomes 7-5 and there hasn't been a dead ball, you probably don't want to use the timeout anymore.
I disagree. Like when I mentor state coaches, I'd talk to them about, you had a reason for calling that timeout. So again, like, as you said, whatever the reason is, there was a reason. So just because you've now made a shot, I don't think that reason changes. It probably extends it longer, but the challenge is probably still there. So I'm a big believer, if you've had that gut feel that you've got to call that time out, get the group together, whatever reasoning, stay with that. You know, like, don't be bluffed by a bucket and make that change. You can't live in the moment. You've got to see the bigger picture.
I think the other part to it is you can't actually take the time out home with you at the end of the game. And you do see it often. I saw a couple of games at the Junior Championships in Townsville in April, and the games were absolutely changed when a timeout was blown. Middle of the third quarter or early in the third quarter when the opposition went on a run, the game changed because the coach did a great job of calling a timeout, and it just settled things down, and their team was able to right the ship.
I think that's a great point too. There's always been a little bit of a fear, I think, from coaches. I mean, as a general rule, those that coach at sort of the VC level or the champs level and things like that, you'll tend to get two timeouts in the first half and three in the second. Is the amount of coaches that really fear blowing a second timeout in the third quarter. And I get it in terms of you want to make sure you got two down the stretch if you can. But if you need that timeout, you blow that timeout. You don't hold on to it.
You got to stop the bleeding when you got to stop the bleeding. Yep. I've been one of those coaches that I love having two in the last. So I just love it. You know, it's just almost a safety net. But over time, and Brad Davidson, when he was working with Basketball Australia, once said something to me when actually Zepp and I were coaching under 20s and we were playing the first Victoria side, which kind of had our national team in it. And we were out of timeouts, we had nothing. He said, you know, like, just figure out other ways to stop the run. And one of the things was, you know, like, just sub on every possession. I was like, that's a great idea. And so, you know, again, through trial and error, I've used that. There's that way to get stoppages, you know, like, actually get the player to hold the ball and throw it to the ref. Like, we'll get a warning, but it stops the run. We can communicate a bit more.
Just take momentum out of the other side.
Just find a way to kill momentum. The other one is foul.
Yeah, free throws matter.
You know, like, just foul. A free throw is an opportunity for us to talk to our players. So, you know, whether that's through the point guard or it's us directly to someone, putting them to the line while you are giving up two is still another way to kill that momentum.
Might be down 9-0.
Maybe. And look, there's been games like at NBL level where, in hindsight, I just wish we fouled and just stopped that run and maybe that's enough. But yeah, that's always why you've got to review and think about a different way next time.
I'll come from the other angle, using the foul line, but how's about, as a coach, if you have a contingency plan? So, okay, at any one time we're against a scoring run, we need to get to the foul line offensively.
Yep.
So what set can you run for your athlete, maybe your best penetrating athlete, post-dominant athlete, whatever it is, to get to the foul line yourself? Because if you are down 7-0, 9-2, whatever it is, and can make two foul shots, it's a great evener for you now.
Definitely.
Okay, because you can now catch your breath. What is that go-to set? And your players will know, because if you call fist or black, whatever it is, this is, you know, we need to get to the foul line.
And I think there's stuff like that that you can really get the whole group to understand. Two-for-one scenario is another one where if they know that there's 34 seconds and above, which is kind of my personal number where we automatically go 2-for-1 because that's our belief. Now, has it backfired at times? Yes. Has it been successful? Yes.
Yeah.
But that's not what's going to sway us. That's who we are. But that's what we're going to do. You know, like scenarios like that, that you know, all right, team's going on a 6-0 run. This is the action we're going to run because we know we're guaranteeing ourselves a great look, a chance for a free throw, etc. That's a great thing to have in your toolkit if you're the head coach.
Yeah. And just going back to your point a little bit there, Mike, as you say, get to the foul line yourself. Most teams, I find, when they're down 9-0, the opposition will be up and in the lanes. So you just may need to say, hey, we're going to run our fist set, but run it with the dribble winner. See if you can stop them from jumping up in the lanes and getting that extra steal, which causes more problems.
So, you know, we've hit timeout usage. One of the big things is understanding why you're using the timeout. So, you know, I'm not saying you have to huddle with your staff, but you need to have a clear understanding of what you're wanting to try and achieve in that. What do you guys do out of timeout when the opposition calls it? Like, for me, that's when I really like messing with people. Like, we're going to change something here. They've called a timeout because they're concerned. Well, let's show something
zone
else.
Possession or
blitz them.
Trap something.
Do something else. I think that's a great opportunity as well to keep making them feel the pain. So you've got, you know, both ledges of this thing if the timeout is called.
John Wooden's philosophy was he will never call the first timeout of the game. Like, that was a part of what he did. He said, we'll be the best physically ready team, fittest team. He'll never call the first time out. And he used that as a part of his philosophy and strategy. Make them call the first time out. They're going to call it, draw something up. We'll change up what we're doing defensively or offensively and kind of catch them off guard that
way.
He
also had the number one ranked team every year
for a long time. Maybe that's a part of his philosophy.
Yeah, but again, that is exactly it. You've got to know your cattle. You've got to know the IQ of your group. Like, are we a group that can afford for the run to be 9-0 and we're going to be okay? Like, you know, my team last year, we weren't that. Like, so it had to be different, where hopefully this year I've got a group that's different in that sense. So knowing the personnel, knowing what you can actually do, and then if you can sell that, I think that's a strength as well.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, the understanding of why we want to use timeouts to the group is pretty important. Like, if they understand, you know, we don't want it to get to a 7-0 run, so our execution right now needs to be great because otherwise we've got to burn a timeout. That's important for the athletes to know as well.
Absolutely.
Also, being mindful of change for the sake of change isn't necessarily a good thing. Like, just because you have the other team call the timeout doesn't necessarily mean that you need to change what you're doing. I mean, there is certainly an element of, hey, if you've been in a press, there's a good chance they're blowing that timeout to talk about their press break. So that might be a case of, hey, we'll take that press off for one or two possessions, but then it goes back on. Yeah. Make the opposition forget about what their rules were, guard it straight up, whatever the case may be. But there have been plenty of times in games where I've seen coaches blow timeouts, and I've done it myself, and I'm sort of thinking, hey, this would be a great time to go to a 1-2-2 trap or something like that. We get cut to ribbons, and all of a sudden I have to blow the timeout.
Yeah.
You do have to change with purpose.
This is another thing out of the timeout, is coaches are creatures of habit, and I wonder how many teams actually run the same out-of-timeout set every single timeout that they call. And this is a little bit advanced. Like, you would need some film and be able to compile that over time. But for our state coaches, this is absolutely something that we would talk about.
Definitely something you track. Absolutely.
I know I certainly did it with Sports Code. Yeah. We always had our guys track when the timeout was, and I wanted the first set out of the timeout because there was a team probably 2 years ago, I think, but always ran the same backdoor play out of a timeout. When normally your kids have come out of the timeout, they're up and in, they're energetic, and all of a sudden back cut, and that takes the air out of it again.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's a couple of coaches in the NBL that do it. Yep. You know, like, there's guys on the Seawall that you knew they were going to run one of their trick actions, so we'd zone it out of a timeout. Like, but that's part of coaching, is figuring out what is your advantage, how can you use those timeouts to your advantage. And I think that's what, you know, we're really hitting here.
Mm.
You know, scoring runs should be a time that we use timeouts. Absolutely. Yeah. When else, though?
Yeah.
Like that, you know, when else are you going to use that?
Well, if you got a timeout left and you have possession with 14 seconds to go in the half, can you draw something up? Like, how is your ability as a coach to communicate that? Robbie and I talk a lot about the skill of an athlete in just being able to draw something up. Or maybe you have a set play, but you need to run a certain wrinkle or a change up to what you usually do, but we're going to go, you know, this is usually A, let's do B this time. Can they actually follow the direction on the whiteboard and get that done in 14 seconds?
Yeah.
Using a timeout late in the half, there's nothing wrong with that if you've got the ball, or if you need to get a stop as well.
What about calling timeouts from a position of power? So just say you're up 10, are you going to blow that timeout, even if your offense has maybe been a little bit clunky and things like, and things haven't really been going perfectly, but the scoreboard dictates you're in a really good spot. Would you still blow that timeout?
I mean, say you're up 16 with 4 minutes to go in the game and the opposition come down and they get a rhythm three and then a layup and now you're up 11 with 3:50 to go or 3:45 to go. Call a timeout.
Yeah, I think...
Talk about it.
To me, scoring runs is what you're really looking at. Like, scoreboard doesn't matter. Scoring run does. So that example is a prime one of that. The other part, though, is if you just feel like you're taking the foot off the pedal a bit, or now we're getting sloppy, the games are over until it's over. So absolutely, like, if you get that feeling that something's not right here, you've got to use it.
A lot of that will come back to your philosophy too. So if you're like a defensive transition, that's your thing, and you give up two layups in transition, it's a 4-point run, so it's not to 7. But if that irks you so much that you know that from here things are going to head downhill, time out. And you've seen Coach Popovich do this in the NBA. He'll call a timeout with like 11:10 to go in the first quarter because they've had probably two breakdowns that they've covered that morning in shoot-around, and it just irks him that much that we have to talk about this or it's going to be a long 48 minutes for us.
And you do need to be a little bit mindful of that. There are certainly times where it can be really disrespectful to blow the timeout as well. If you're up 18 points with 13 seconds to go, probably not a great time to blow one. I know we all want to try and run our offense and try and diagram something for your kids to do that, but I'd probably try and save that for your training sessions because it's a fairly nasty feeling on the other end of that if you're having that blown, and what do you tell your kids at that point?
Coaching should be a fraternity where we, you want what's best for the coach there on the other end after the 40 minutes. Absolutely. So don't try and embarrass people in that. But I also believe in coaching right to the end.
Correct.
Absolutely. So at no point do you take your foot off the gas. But you can do that in a respectful way.
And absolutely. That might be different if you're dealing with, say, head-to-head and point spread. And, hey, you know, we actually really... Although we're winning this game, we need an extra 2 points to get the head to
Well, that's different.
Yeah. That's very different. Though, just from a cultural point, like, I know I've spoken to our state coaches about not leaving timeouts on the board, you know, especially if we're losing it. Like, make sure we're coaching our athletes the whole way. But also culturally, like, they need to see that you're competitive even when you're up and figuring out, you know, that matters.
Tournament play, if you're talking... late game still, you know, Tuesday's game will still help you win Wednesday's game.
Absolutely.
So 5 minutes to go in the fourth, up 16, down 16, whatever it is, you've got to treat it like, well, this is the mid part of the tournament, we've still got to get better day.
And the other part of that is the game is rhythm.
Yeah.
So, you know, you want to keep your rhythm going as long as you can. If that leads into the next day, that's a great thing. Like, that's why we use timeouts, to figure out strategies, to kill the rhythm, to find an advantage, etc. Like, that's a pretty good option.
Yeah.
Yep. So, assuming we don't have timeouts or we don't get the opportunity, what are some of the other ways you can change up a momentum shift? Like, I know you spoke about taking time off the clock and delaying, but personnel-wise, like, what are some of the better ways to change the dynamic of a game, I suppose, by maybe substitutions?
Well, to me, the biggest part to always look at is what's time and score telling us. So if we're down, you know, 11 and there's 4 minutes to go, whatever we've been doing is going to keep giving us that result. So that straight away is a trigger to change it. Now, if we've been trying to play quick, that's an idea that, all right, well, maybe now we've actually just got to get good looks and really chip at it that way, get to the foul line, stop the clock, do things like that that may help us change that result. Often it's the defensive side that you need to change, because you've either been sitting back or you've been playing too quick, and that's where you're getting hurt. So trying to figure that out and using that time and score to then... all right, that's my gauge to go, yep, now I need to make a change.
Substitutions are important, mate. Before any season, for the last few years with my assistant coaching staff, we've done a couple of things in planning for the year, and one of them is lineup analysis. And what I'd like each of our staff members to do was give me what your best defensive lineup is, your best five defensive lineup, shooting lineup, and your most athletic lineup. And they're different lineups that can swing the game depending on what the game calls for. If you need stops, you know, your best five defenders on the floor, what is that lineup look like? If you need to speed the game up, your most athletic team, what does that look like? We're down six, 24 seconds to go with the ball, need to make shots, what does the best shooting team line up? What sets can we run with that shooting team lineup? So that is a bit of planning from prior to
and
the game.
That, I'd probably even consider if you're up by a couple of points and the other team's going to foul. Yep. What you want your best free throw shooting line is also a really valuable one, I feel like. But I like the idea of that. I mean, I've always tried to sort of say, well, okay, if we're on the back foot, how do we assert some dominance? That might be either we go really big and we say, hey, we're just going to pound that thing inside and make you guard us there, or we go really small and just try and change the tempo of that. Either the guards have been a little bit ratty so far and try and get a little bit of that back.
Yeah, it comes back to contingency planning again. Like, you'll know who you're playing against that Friday night or that Sunday night. If they've got a dominant post player and, you know, there's a good chance they could be 3 for 4 in the first quarter, what do we do now? What does our lineup change look like? What's our substitution pattern look like? What are we going to do now? Are we blitzing the post? Well, we've got to make sure we've got length on the floor to blitz the post. So how are your substitution patterns roll in with the circumstance that the game asks for?
Yep. Okay, what about foul trouble with athletes? So I've assisted some coaches that have always been of the opinion that, hey, 2 fouls in the first half means you sit for the rest of the first half. And I've sort of had a little bit of a to and fro with that personally, because it's like, well, how many times do you sub that kid out of the first half and then they finish the game on 2 fouls and you've cost yourself all those minutes where they could have been playing? Do either of you guys have like a little bit of a trigger or anything like that in terms of
three in the first half? I definitely don't want to risk a fourth in the first half. Two in the first, I don't know, like sometimes I feel that really kills a player's rhythm. It also depends though on who the player is. So if they are likely to pick up a third, then they're out. But if it's one of my spine players that kind of knows how to manage themselves, then maybe not. I find it's harder with bigs because to be honest. Bigs are refereeing different. Like, they're more likely to get a call that isn't really there. And then matchup-wise, like, it's a physical contest. So, you know, that may change my mind if it's my center. But generally speaking, three in the first half will just shelve you until the second half, but that'd be the only one.
Yeah, so if your best player is a perimeter kind of player, is there a player for the other team that he or she can defend that isn't a slasher? Like, can they defend a catch-and-shoot player?
Can you hide them? Can you go to zone?
Can you play a zone?
Yeah, you know, like, correct. Tell them to really pull it back.
And then you won't draw up any sets for them on the flip side of them driving to the basket. They might get a charge call, whatever the deal may be.
It's funny, though, because I think players can really manage the defensive side not getting another foul.
Yeah.
It's the offensive side, actually, is where they generally pick up that extra one.
They go and chase a board over like the top
just,
of someone.
Yeah, like, they just get the run. And that's the thing. And, you know, again, is your bench deep enough where you can afford to have that player off the court? Hopefully you've upskilled your whole group and you can manage the 2-3 minutes to halftime or not. But if you don't think you can, well, then you've got to figure out a strategy on how to keep them on and hide them a bit.
I mean, there have been times I've left kids in the game with 3 fouls in the first half, because it can also be a bit of a mental thing for refs. And, hey, I've called 2 fouls on this kid. I know they've got 3 now. I don't want to give them another one. They can occasionally get away with things too.
I don't want to give this one away, but I've spoken to a lot of referees on this. I read something where in pro leagues, if a player goes into that last quarter with, well, in our league, 4 fouls, that player fouls out only 6% of the time. So I think there is definitely something where the referee knows, well, that's their stud, and now I'd be shocked, or not shocked, mortified if I gave that advice and then that player does foul out and it's on me. But so don't use that as gospel, but like, there is something in that, I do believe. And, you know, use Casey Prather as an example. We had a game a while back where, you know, he had his 4th foul. Now, he was brilliantly smart at not getting that 5th, but he didn't foul out and backed him and went with it. So there is something about, you know, trying to get a gauge for how's the game being officiated. Is it a game where, you know, it's as the course is going on, it's not as tight. Maybe now they can survive a bit longer. Really figure those things out.
This comes to athlete IQ as well. Like, if I have 3 with 7 minutes to go in the game,
don't stick your hand in.
Don't put your hand in. And if you want coach to trust you on the floor with 4 fouls and 7 minutes to go in the last quarter, you've got to show some IQ that you're not going to foul, that you're not going to go over the back and try to get an offensive tip, things like that. So, and that's all teaching and coaching, which, you know, takes place in the practice floor.
It is. I mean, I was watching a coaching DVD with John Calipari maybe a couple of years ago, who was really big on the dribble drive system at that point. And he was teaching a lot of his players to finish with contact because he found within their system, they drew a lot of fouls. The refs would say, hey, we've called 7 fouls on the opposition in the first 4 or 5 minutes. We're not going to call anymore. So he had to condition his players to start playing and accepting contact because it may not get called this time around. But I think the foul line is a great area where we can condition athletes to, okay, let's try and keep the opposition off the foul line. But how would you go and target a team that you've managed to get in foul trouble in that situation where, okay, the refs may have blown 7 early, all of a sudden they're not blowing into them for the last 3 or 4 minutes. How do you still not make a big deal of that in terms of, hey, we're not necessarily getting the same call we were before, but we still need to keep playing?
For me, I've never made it a focus point. Like, I think what you can do is run your action that has more heading towards the rim, which gives you a greater percentage chance of it. But to actually go, well, you know, we need to try and find a way on that, I'm not sure that ever works. I do believe it works first quarter.
Yep.
They run a lot of action that's towards the rim because generally the game's tighter then, especially if it's tournament play. Day one of a tournament, the first quarter's always ref the tightest. So, you know, knowing that stuff matters. But to me, it's about the athlete's IQ and understanding what actions are actually going to get us the best percentage chance to get to the foul line.
Yeah, and, you know, the thing that you'll see from the VJBL sidelines is the parents are acutely aware that the other team's in foul trouble, and the people watching the game, or the spectators, and now the thought is just drive, drive, drive. Well, it takes you out of your offensive rhythm. Now you're at risk of a charge call. Now you're at risk of getting not rhythm shots within the context of your offense. So, like what Justin just said, if you can prescribe something within your system, offensive system, absolutely, but be careful just to say they've got 4 fouls, we're in the bonus, just drive, 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 because you've seen it go both ways.
And I think that also ties in with switching defenses. Yeah. So teams that will switch out big to small, and that it can be really disjointing for a lot of offensive teams, because they'll see the mismatch and go, hey, we now need to stop running our set, stop running whatever our system is, and we just got to pound that thing in there and let the big go to work. And so many times it takes ages off the clock and it doesn't work.
Yeah, but you've got to have a package for that. Yeah. Like, that's something that's prior to the game. You've got to have some stuff that you can run against switching defenses, whatever it is. Slips, reverses, whatever it works out to be. Isolations.
That's why most teams switch late clock, because you spend so much time trying to get it to the mismatch, you run out of time anyway. Right. I know that's what we've always done. It's like, you know, good luck, go throw it in and see if you make a bucket late clock and get it, you know, waste your time killing your own rhythm. But yeah.
Easy. So, end of clock situation, so we're talking end of shot clock, also end of quarter clocks. Offensively, defensively, it'll dictate a little bit, obviously, the time and score. But what are some of the things you're looking at on the defensive end with late clock? I know you've just sort of spoken about switching, Justin. What if you are up by 3 points, opposition team has the last shot?
For me, that's the best one. I've always thought you want to have winning as the last part of that play phase. So to me, fouling and putting them to the line is definitely a genuine,
statistically
genuine option. Yeah. You know, it's two shots versus them sticking a three, or God forbid someone fouling that three and now you're losing. To me, though, it's also that's personnel driven as well. Do you have a group that you just know can get it done defensively and are going to contest, and you back them to still get it done in overtime? Maybe. The other part is, are you on the road or are you at home?
Yeah.
Because that there's an emotional factor in the game. That, you know, things, weird things happen when emotion's in it. So knowing all those elements definitely make it up. But for me personally, we would foul, put them to the line and back ourselves and get a rebound if they try and miss it, and the game's done.
Mm. Late clock, I mean, through the game, you know, how many times during the game are you going to face that last 8, 9, 10 seconds of the shot clock offensively? So when I played my college ball, our call was butter. Like, whenever the shot clock got to 10, everyone just started hollering butter, and we got into our late clock set, which I've seen, you know, teams run horns action, spread pick and roll, some floppy action, whatever it is. Having a plan for late clock, I've seen be the undoing of a lot of good teams by having no plan. You've got to have a plan for late clock defensively, like Justin just spoke about. But offensively, what are your spots on the floor? What action are we going to run? So when that clock says 9 or 10 and you make your call, whatever it is, black, blue, doesn't matter, what are we doing? Because you still got to get a quality shot. You can't just let the shot clock become the reason why we're going to shoot a contested two.
Yeah. Would you just say, for example, I'm just throwing out yet another random hypothetical here, you get scored on with 8 seconds to go, you have a timeout. Are you always blowing that timeout, or are you trusting your guard to say, hey, you know what, get that thing in and get them going before the D gets a chance to get set on that?
What's the scoreboard say?
You're down by a point.
That's a great question, because I think that's the value of having an elite point guard and also having time to work with your group and knowing what the plan is. There is something great about just being able to inbound, go and get it, and it's done. And if you've been able to spend the time on that, you trust your point guard to the nth degree, do it. If you don't have those feelings, I'd be calling the timeout and trying to draw up your go-to late clock, that scenario play. And everyone should have something in their pocket that you've won practice, that you're not drawing up in the moment. And two, you know, that you, or your staple side out of bounds, but you can now get a wrinkle out of that to get the shot that you need.
And what you need to figure out is, based on the team you're coaching, like under 14s is different from under 18s, which is different from Siegel, figure out what that point of time is. So is 8 seconds enough for where you can say, okay, the ball can come out of the net and it takes us 8 seconds to get down and go dribble, handoff, ball screen, jump shot? Or for my under 14s or under 16s, do I need 12 seconds, 13 seconds? That's stuff that you can work on at practice.
Or can you get the same shot if you do advance the ball from the side? Yeah,
correct. And then all of a sudden, again, you take the emotion out of it. The clock says 12 and a half. I need 13 seconds. Can't do it. Timeout. Yeah. We need to get into our set.
And that's massive.
Advancing the ball makes a difference.
Statistically, it actually gets the defense set.
Right.
So probably your chances may drop a little bit.
And analytics say 5-on-5, you're in the worst chance of having success. But what you said is being able to remove emotion in those parts is huge. So if you can build your team to understand the philosophy of what we're doing, in 2-for-1s. Mm. What we're doing 10 seconds and under when we're down. What we're doing 10 seconds and under when we're up.
Yeah.
You know, all those sorts of things. If that the whole group know it, they've drilled it, and they're great at it, now emotion can be removed a bit because we know what we've got to do here. When you're trying to figure stuff out on the fly, yeah, then you're in trouble.
Mike Tyson, one of the great quotes all the time, like, everyone's got a plan until they get punched in the mouth. Like, you've got a plan. Yeah. Of course you've got a plan, but it's not going to go to plan all the time. Yeah. What happens now, and what happens can't be based on emotion. It's got to be based on scoreboard, clock, foul trouble, whatever it is, yeah, in basketball that we value.
Yeah, I think that's really important. Would you call a timeout to allow the offense to get a set? So just imagine you're on defense, ball goes out of court, and you're up by 2 points for argument's sake. Would you ever call that timeout with you on defense to give the opposition a chance at that because you feel like it helps your defense, or never give them even a look?
Never, mate. Like, yeah, you've got to keep the advantage always in your pocket. So if you can create an advantage out of that, then maybe. But
like, they've got no timeouts?
They got no timeouts.
Yeah,
no.
I wouldn't be throwing them a chance to organize and go.
What I will do, though, if I've got no timeouts, I'm calling a sub.
Yep.
Unless I've got my best five players or that's the five I want, I will call a sub and then try to get a sub in as slowly as possible so I can now draw something up on the fly and then hopefully make that... Well, that'll now throw you off at the other end.
The only reason I would want a sub is then they can't run it at you. So the advantage that we were talking, 10 seconds under, if they have the plan and can get it in, well, now maybe there is a chance. But you know, if you can stop the clock, have your D set up, now they're really... pushing it uphill, good.
Excellent. Anything else you can sort of think of from game strategy in terms of trying to get a win in a difficult situation?
I think there's definitely some stuff, though, from a philosophy point that, you know, you can have as a coach that maybe you can help. So, like, you know, you're talking about 10 seconds under is butter. Like, for us, runs of 3 stops was something that we were really massive on in tracking and making sure that, you know, if we could get 8 in a game, we didn't lose.
Yep.
So that was kind of a focus. We called them turkeys. So similar, like, once we had 2, benches yelling turkey. So now, you know, everyone knows, yep, let's get this 3rd stop. Something like that. I think charting deflections, you know, having a strategy around what is a, you know, why would you? And for me, it's a great indicator of whether your D's on or if you're slacking that night. But then, too, knowing, well, how many deflections turns into a positive result.
Yeah, and in-game analysis, I'd like to have an assistant charting how the opposition's actually scoring. Like, are we giving up multiple points off straight-line drives? Yeah. Are we giving multiple points up off side pick and roll? Because then at half-time, at least you're not going to walk into the change room or address your team with just a whole heap of, you know, they're scoring too much. Well, no, they're actually running too good a side of pick and roll. We have to change up our side pick and roll coverage. We just have to do a better job of what our plan is. Figuring that out is important because you want real data and real information in the game so your athletes can then take that and make the adjustment or the change.
3 things I'll always ask going into the change room. What's working for us?
Yeah.
What's hurting us? What do we need to change? And they're the 3 points that we're selling at the halftime. If you try and go in and cover another 8 things, now you're not going to change or stay on course. So, you know, hitting those 3 things has always been pretty important, I believe, and then now you're able to send things in the direction, hopefully, that you need going out of the halftime.
Yeah.
Excellent. Hopefully that's some assistance for you guys. Again, any interaction you guys want to have with us, by all means, just hit us up on the email or on Twitter. Please do leave a review as well as a rating, and hopefully that's helped out with your coaching. We'll see you guys next week for the second, or for the last episode for the
season wrap-up.
Yeah, done. Good luck with your coaching.
For this week's Shot Clock, we're down at Vic Uni in Footscray with the Helping Hoop Futures guys. And I've got Nima Sabani here that's done a lot of work with these guys. Nima, tell us a little bit about the work you put in with these guys.
So I've had the privilege of working with the kids at Helping Hoop's Future the last couple of years. The first year I was in more of an assistant role as a volunteer. In the last 12 months, I've been the head coach of the program out here in Footscray. Started off in early 2017 with around 8-10 kids, and now we're looking at around 35 to 40 on average every week. It's been amazing.
Yeah, it's awesome. And you also coached the Collingwood Big V men last year in D2 and managed to take out the title, and you guys move up this year.
Yeah, well, I was very lucky to have head coach of the team, Ghani Sakiri, ask me to jump on board as an assistant after, I guess, seeing some of the stuff I'd been doing with the South Sudanese teams in the tournaments, and jumped on as an assistant. Incredible ride, a lot of bumps along the way. We ended up winning the title, and we're moving into Div 1 now. So exciting times.
That's awesome. All right, we'll get started on the shot clock. What was the first team you ever coached?
First team I ever coached was probably me and my two younger brothers growing up in Japan, but in a more serious capacity was the Solomon Islands under 21 national team about 12 months ago. For about 3 months when I was volunteering through the islands, I jumped on and helped them kind of getting ready for the South Pacific Games.
That's fantastic. What's your favorite NBA team?
At the moment, I think it's hard to go past the San Antonio Spurs, how they play, but I'm a Canadian, so Toronto Raptors as well.
And what's your favorite NBL team?
100% Melbourne United. I have been in Australia for 10 years. I'm an Australian, proudly an Australian as well, and Melbourne United is my squad.
Excellent. And what's your favorite WNBL team?
Again, I think it's the Boomers. You got to represent the hometown talent and, you know, definitely the Melbourne squads.
Excellent. What's your most used coaching phrase?
Most used coaching phrase, I would say maybe the last few months with the numbers I've been working with, the idea of locking in, just getting them to be 150% attentive, and then everything else kind of flows in. So I just ask them to lock in.
150%? That's more than the 110 we usually get. Any coaching superstitions?
No superstitions, really, but... Yeah, I just kind of, you know, the hour or two before, I just try to get the music pumping and just stay in a positive vibe, because I think once you're in a good mood, you're able to kind of relay that to your players. So I think maybe, if anything, just throw down a few really upbeat tracks on my way to the stadium.
You've done well here, as Adam McKay just sort of tries to audio bomb this, I think, for lack of a better term. What's a coach you always steal from?
100%, it's Coach Pop. I think I could watch hours of that guy. And the 0.5 that Mike, you know, Zeppel was talking about, it's something that I actually used last week of practice. So it's Coach Pop.
Favorite coaching website?
To be honest, a lot of the stuff that you guys are putting out, the resources, David Herbert on Facebook puts incredible stuff out through the Geelong page. And then also a lot of the FIBA stuff, the World Association of Coaches, and the FIBA material that's coming out, I just feel is very digestible and easy to kind of follow. So very helpful.
Excellent. And your favorite coaching podcast?
Been listening to a lot of Coaching You. Have started to listen to you guys, but really the last, you know, 4 or 5 years, it's been a lot of Bill Simmons and Zach Lowe in terms of their interviews with coaches. I feel like just listening to an hour of a coach's philosophy is just mind-blowing, and hearing how they approach the game. So,
yeah. Awesome. Thanks very much for your time there. It's fantastic, this Helping Hoops Futures program they have down here. Strongly recommend coaches get involved and have a little bit of a look at it. Thanks for your time, and good luck with everything you're coming up.
Thank you very much, Rob. You're a legend. Cheers.
For the second half of today's podcast, I'd like to welcome Bill Mildenhall, who is the Technical Officials Manager for Basketball Victoria. Thanks for joining us, Bill.
Thanks, Rob.
No worries. So I've condensed your refereeing career fairly heavily here. We'll just say you've refed a lot of NBL games, a lot of international games, a couple of Olympics, been a referee, supervisor at Olympics and World Champs, as well as, what's your role with FIBA at the moment?
I'm one of the FIBA Technical Commission members, so yep. There's now increased number, we're up to about 20 representatives from around the world, and I'm one of those.
Excellent. So, long story short, we blame you for the rule changes that we're about to discuss at the
Correct.
Moment. Excellent. Okay.
Except I was only one voice, so I kept emphasising one out of 20, remember?
That's all right. So, what we're going to try and do, because there have been a lot of changes, probably over the last 2 years, in fact, but probably more importantly, the new travel rule is probably the one that's going to cause the most amount of contention, I would suggest, at all levels of basketball. So you guys, with the Technical Officials Department, have produced a video which sits on the Basketball Victoria website, which I would encourage all coaches to go and have a look at, because it does clear up a lot of things, and there's a lot of things that Bill may talk about here that won't make sense unless you see it.
Correct, yep.
So what is the new travel rule, I suppose, is the first thing, and why has it been introduced?
Well, first off, I guess, if we go to the reasons why it was introduced, I mean, the knowledge or the information that we were given on the Technical Commission, based around pretty much the reverse spin move that players were starting to use and use very effectively. And if you were to analyse the move of a reverse spin move, about 90% of the time a player would actually take an extra step, so they would actually travel. So there was concern about that being allowed, because it is such a spectacular play and everyone was sort of being allowing it to play. The FIBA Technical Commission decided to change the rule a little to enable that to be acceptable, along with the fact that they're trying to unify the rules around the world. And if you were to explain this travel rule to young kids in particular, you just say that it's the NBA rule and they all understand straight away.
Yep.
As a consequence, it is much more in line with the NBA rule. And so basically it is just simply this. When you are gathering the ball or taking control of the ball when you are on the move by either off a pass or dribbling the ball, if you take control of the ball, the first step or the foot that you have on the floor when you take control, previously under our old rules that was regarded as your first step or your pivot foot. Now that's regarded as zero. So now you're entitled to still a 1-2 rhythm, a movement of. So the foot that's on the floor is a zero step. Then you go 1-2 to make a layup or to pass the ball. You won't find the term zero in the rule book. It's just from a teaching perspective, we refer to it as a zero step. And then the rest of the travel rules haven't changed. I mean, the rules haven't changed. It's only referencing a player receiving the ball or gaining control of the ball while on the move.
Yeah. So a player catches on the three-point line and makes a move, those rules stay exactly the same. So we don't need to change anything in terms of the teaching from a coaching perspective. It is literally player catches the ball in transition, and that's probably where it's going to cause the most issues, I would suggest.
Yeah, exactly. And if we think about the reasons behind it, is if you analyse somebody particularly off the dribble, gathering the ball off the dribble, a lot of the times it's very hard for a referee to determine whether they had a foot on the floor when they took control or whether they didn't. And so now this allows that sort of element of doubt, I guess, to be given to the player. So that's a zero step. But all of the other rules are exactly the same, so that nothing has changed with regards to that.
Excellent. And a great point of reference, as you said, is if you just tell the young kids, hey, it's the same as the NBA, they get that. It's the older generations, I suppose, that will probably struggle with that a little bit more, but the young kids will probably understand this a little better. And it's probably is going to make for a more spectacular game, I'd suggest.
I would think. Yeah. I mean, that's the intent, I think, really. The intentions are that it is to make it a little bit... And in particular, if you think about the reverse spin move, it is a really spectacular move, and it's a very handy move. Yep. Difficult to defend, I might add.
Very, even more so now.
But absolutely.
Yeah. And one of the problems with this, I suppose, is that the flow-on effect that this will potentially have in terms of we need to get better at teaching our kids to defend without hands-on, and that leads in a little bit further, I suppose.
Yeah, I guess at the technical commission area, that really wasn't a point of discussion, but I think it's worth considering the impact that it will have and trying to make it, matching it up, I guess, for a defender to be able to defend somebody who has got that extra move and that extra step. But if you think about it, it's really very much emphasis is on being on the move. So yep. It's not the stationary players. It's not sort of the start of the dribble or all those sort of things that are still exactly the same. So it's when you receive the ball from a pass or from your end of the dribble, that's that extra step that you probably get.
And that's probably where it will shine. Obviously, transition will be one thing, but also the finish at the end of the move is where that extra step
Correct.
Will potentially come in.
Yeah.
And there's a great clip of DeAndre Jordan from the Olympics where he probably takes about three steps from half court and he's dunking the ball and he can't believe he's been called for a travel.
Yeah.
Well, under the old rules, that absolutely was. Under the new rules, well, that's now legal.
And correct. That's exactly. And virtually took... took the ball off a pass first, so then around the centre line, and then took that extra zero step, and then started the dribble, and then gathered the ball from the dribble, and then was under the basket and made a layup.
So in terms of the teaching for coaches, I don't think we really need to change too much in terms of what we're teaching in the half court, but it will certainly be the transition buckets that we need to now start looking at a little bit more.
Yeah.
So another of the new rules has been the unsportsmanlike foul rule that's come in. So there was what was probably referred to as a Euro foul previously, which was effectively designed to stop the break. So ball gets kicked out in transition, there might be a steal or something like that if it's one-on-one. And we did have a rule in place, sort of like the open court unsportsmanlike as well previously, but this is literally just to make sure that teams are playing from a legal guarding position. And where it will impact probably the most is the end of the game. So when the ball gets inbounded, teams are trying to foul to stop the clock and put the other team on the foul line. Can you take us through the unsportsmanlike foul rule changes?
It's interesting, Rob. What FIBA now have referenced the unsportsmanlike foul to, what criteria are you using as a referee to make the determination of whether it's an unsportsmanlike foul? And previously we had four criteria, or 4 points that you had to focus on. Now there are five, and the extended one is the C3, which is criteria three. And if I just read that, it's any unnecessary contact caused by the defensive player in order to stop the progress of the offensive team in transition. And this applies until the offensive player begins his active shooting. And as you've pointed out, it's really to stop that Euro foul that was starting to occur, where somebody in transition, there's a turnover, they're about to take off towards the basket, and the defender was in front of them, but the momentum of the offensive player was they were clearly going to get past you, and as a result, the defender would just put their arm out and stop them and foul them. And now there's that under this current criteria now, that would be unnecessary contact, and as a result would be an unsportsmanlike foul. It's very similar to the first criteria, which is not a legitimate attempt to play the ball within the spirit and the intent of the rule. I mean, you can really utilise that sort of criteria in the same way. But they were mindful of, in Europe in particular, they were using this sort of foul, and it became a bit of an ugly part of the game, and particularly at the end of the game. In reference to now wanting to stop the clock, I mean, the emphasis really is going to be on coaches and players to ensure that they make a reasonably legitimate attempt to play at the ball, and to avoid the fact that it can be considered as being unnecessary contact. Yep. So if you're making a... And the examples we have of a couple of videos, there are some examples where a player's coming from not the best position to play from, but he was making a reasonably legitimate attempt to get the ball, and if that was the case, then it would be classified as being a normal foul. However, it's now going to be up to the judgment of the officials again, and that can be a little contentious, no matter whatever happens.
No, and that's a really important part, because that has been a long-standing tactic at the end of games, is to foul, and some people will sit there and say, hey, this is really good because look how high-scoring the games are now. Others will sit there and say, well, why should you give a team that's 8 down with a minute to go a chance to come and win this just on the back of free throws?
Correct, and it's a philosophical argument that you can... I mean, I don't think there's a simple answer to. I mean, some people will say that, okay, one of the arts of the game is to shoot foul shots.
Yep.
And if you shoot foul shots, you know, obviously you're not going to get into trouble. But there is, you know, I've seen games where the last minute of the game, particularly in the World Championships in Spain a number of years ago, the last minute of the game went for about 15 minutes, and it was just boring.
That's because a bit ugly.
they just continually foul.
Yep, it's not something I don't think we want to see in the game, but as coaches, we haven't come up with a better tactic yet either to try and get that back. It's a lot of coaches will press in those last couple of minutes and try and generate some turnovers, and it's like, well, what if you can't? Like, what if you're getting nothing? We haven't come up with anything better yet.
No. Just like all any of the new rules, Rob, I guess coaches then will go away and try and think of ways to get a little bit around that.
But that is half the job.
That's right. Yeah. They understand the principles, I guess the reason is to try and stop that sort of element of the game.
Well, it constantly evolves too. I mean, for every rule that comes in, there's now new teaching that goes with that, and there's something new tactically that will come in as well. It's always changing.
And from our perspective, I guess the issue now will then be, you know, again, it's placing more pressure on the referee to determine whether that was one of those five criteria to decide whether it's an unsportsmanlike foul or not.
Yep.
Now, so all of the other criteria are exactly the same. So if you're passing the ball in the last 2 minutes from out of bounds in the ball and you foul before the ball's passed in, then that's an automatic unsportsmanlike.
Yep.
And also when on a fast break, if there's no defender between the offense, the player being fouled and the basket, then it's automatically a sportsman foul-like foul as well.
So just, I'll give you something without notice because I've only just thought of it. I got asked this the other day and I didn't actually have an answer. The unsportsmanlike foul before the ball gets inbounded. So that's only on the defense?
Yeah, only on the defense. Yeah, absolutely. Yep. Yes. So, which is worth pointing out because some people do misunderstand that.
Yep.
It's purely only on the defense. If you think about the principle, the reason behind it is you're wanting to foul and stop the clock and put them on the line.
That makes sense. It's one of those things. I always claim to know the rules until I come in on a Monday morning and go, Bill, you won't believe what happened on the weekend. And then it's like, oh,
except
dear,
I don't like to own up, but I also have to ask you lots of these sort of questions as well.
So there has been a little bit of a change in terms of the definition of active shooting. So fouls that occur, just say a player drives the ball, they pick up their dribble, they get fouled, but they pass the ball. So there's been a little bit of a change in that as well.
Yeah, this was a bit contentious because we were always of the impression in Australia some years ago that in fact was the rule.
Yep.
And then at a World Championships or whatever, we saw that it actually wasn't applied. And as a consequence, we then sort of made some further inquiries. And as a result, now I think this is probably the Australian rules because it's now been clarified clearly that if a player is in the act of shooting but then decides to dish the ball, so gets fouled in the act of shooting but passes the ball to a teammate, immediately they've made the pass to the teammate, then that eliminates the fact that it's now a shooting foul, or they don't get rewarded with two shots on the line. So it leaves the onus, I guess, up to the player as to whether they're going to be confident enough that the referee's going to make a call, and that obviously then they'll go to the line. And if they want to be a good team player, I guess they try and make the pass and avoid the possibility of relying on the referee.
Yep. And that probably leads a little bit into the continuation sort of ruling as well, I suppose, when players are on the drive, they pick up their dribble, they get fouled, and it's like, well, where does the shooting motion actually start? Yeah. When does it become two shots, and when doesn't it become two shots?
The key to that, Rob, is really clear. Once you take control of the ball or gather the ball in a normal shooting motion, then as long as you don't take an additional step, then you are deemed to be in the act of shooting. So if you gather the ball like your normal shooting motion, and you can be quite a distance from the hoop.
Yeah, absolutely.
That still means that you're in your shooting action and therefore would be resulting in foul shots.
Yep, definitely. So the flopping rule is something I hate to get into the block charge with referees because there is so much grey area. And
Can I just clarify one thing? It's not called flopping anymore. No, it's called faking.
Faking, okay. Yes. It's a little bit more G-rated, I suppose, is probably the idea behind that. We see it a lot in NBL and WNBL at the moment where players will get a warning early on, then they can potentially follow up with another call later on depending on how it's gone. Talk us through how they determine, or referees determine, what is faking and what is not faking, because that's got to be tough.
It is, again, extremely tough. And I mean, they changed the term from flopping to faking so that it wasn't necessarily... Flopping sort of made the emphasis really that somebody who was trying to draw a foul would fall over or whatever and overemphasise the contact. Now it can be both offensive and defensive. Yep. So, you know, faking the same sort of faking the action. So, again, it's exaggerating the contact, or if there is contact, exaggerating the contact to overemphasise what's actually happened. Unfortunately... It appears to be really, I think the aim of the rule is to try to eliminate it.
Yep.
I'm not sure whether it actually has eliminated it or not. In Europe, the general consensus has been they really tightened it up about a year or two ago. And because of the tightening up, then actually it has been reduced. We're probably in the phase of still tightening it up.
Yep.
And as a consequence, I think there's been some sort of controversial calls that are made. One of the things that also that it's within the rule is everybody assumes that you actually have to be given a warning. If the fake is so flagrant and so obvious, and it can result in an automatic technical foul, it doesn't necessarily mean that you have to be warned. But usually, we suggest to referees that they indicate with the fake movement of their hand, and then next opportunity they stop the game and then go and inform the coach that a particular player has been warned for faking.
Yep.
And normally if there's the one warning, that's a one warning for the team. So, and then if anyone from the team then is adjudicated as doing the same thing again, then it becomes a technical foul.
Excellent. And it's got to be tough from a refereeing perspective, and from a playing perspective, too, I'd suggest, purely because there's a little bit of a myth, I suppose, that you need to fall over to get the tech, to get the charge called for you. But if you fall over too willingly, I suppose, well, then that's also a flop. So it's a really line ball call. It's so hard to sort of get that right.
It is very, and it is becoming, I think it's becoming more and more difficult to determine, maybe because our players are getting better at disguising the contact. I guess the thing that we try to teach the referees is to try to determine the amount of contact and the resultant factor to that. So if someone really comes down completely out of control and they're a fairly solid player and they run into a little guy, the chances are that the little guy's going to be thrown back considerably. But if it's in reverse, you know, that and the big guy falls to the floor and, you know, it's only been hit by a small guy, there's a chance that they're trying to overemphasise the contact. But again, there's no simple solution to this one, Rob. It's just a judgment call from the referee's perspective. I can tell you, in all honesty, they don't like it either.
Yeah, it makes perfect sense. No, exactly right. So there's still confusion, and I put this in purely because I'm still confused about it, in all honesty. I have not asked for a cross-court violation to be called in the last 3 to 4 years, purely because I don't understand it myself, and it's just like, you know what, we're not even going to bother dealing with this anymore. I know a lot of other coaches are in the same sort of boat, I'd suggest. Can you give us a brief overview of what that rule actually is?
I can probably tell you the referees are in exactly the same position. Yeah. however, we do try to teach them the rule. I mean, basically, the rule is simply this. You must have, to be in your front court, to be deemed to be in your front court, you must have both feet and the ball in the front court. Now, once you're deemed to be in the front court, then obviously the rules of going back into the back court apply. But if you straddle the line, or if you have 2 feet in the front court but are dribbling the ball in the back court, then you're not deemed to be in the front court as yet, and as a consequence, you can go back and forth or whatever.
Yep.
It's only the deeming of where you are is you must have the ball and both feet wherever they are determines whether you're in the front court or in the back court.
Yep.
Now, to be in the front, you must have all three. That's the key that we try to teach referees to understand, you know, that the three things are there for them to be in the front. And now if the ball goes back into the backcourt, then they're responsible.
So I guess any part of, once you've got all 3 points in the front court, anything that goes into the backcourt
then is deemed to be in backcourt. Yep. Yeah. Now it's, again, I think what you're identifying with coaches is, in all honesty, is probably what happens with referees too. It's, sometimes it's very difficult for them to determine. They're a little confused as well. So the consequence is that they generally don't call it. So not that we encourage them to do so. You know, we want them to call that correctly. But, if you're a smart referee and it was a bit touch and go, then you're more than likely to let it go.
No, excellent. So that probably covers off all the new rules. The only other probably part I'd suggest, what is the best way to deal with referees in general, because as coaches we tend to be on the front foot with this and say, hey, it's my job to go in and try and get calls from my team. It's like, well, actually, it's not really your job to do that. It's your job to probably coach your kids, and I've certainly been guilty of it in the past with plenty of people. But what is the best way to at least have a good working relationship with the referees that are in your game?
There are a number of steps, I guess, that we sort of tried, and obviously it's an area of concern of ours, and we try to educate and train our referees as best as possible. One of the things I always point out to coaches, though, is the first thing you have to understand is the people you're dealing with, the referees whom you would be dealing with, are generally younger than you are. They're in a development phase, just like the players, I guess, that you're coaching a lot of the times. They're still learning. Immediately they get challenged, they get very defensive. And a lot of the times the reasoning for the challenge is probably relevant and they've probably made an error, but sometimes it's very difficult for them to admit to the fact that they have made an error. And as a consequence, when you challenge them, they get defensive. Their only avenue to avoid the defensive, you contacting them or making communications with them, is they warn a technical foul or they just give you a technical foul, because that's what it says in the rule book. That's really pretty much their only avenue to. Now, the more experienced referees and the better referees have a great rapport with coaches and players, and they're able to sort of then get their point across, explain to the player, and then generally speaking, they walk away reasonably happy. Unfortunately, when we're dealing with a lot of referees, I mean, for our VJBL and Big V, we need 260 referees on a weekend. So it's a hell of a lot of referees that to try to get every one of them the skills to be able to communicate with people. A lot of the times these people are fairly young and inexperienced, as I pointed out, but also they haven't had a lot of life experiences either, and immediately being challenged by somebody sort of puts up their defensive mechanisms, and as a result they don't answer appropriately. A lot of the times I get a little bit annoyed too, because, I mean, the coach exactly knows what they're doing most of the time, and they're really just trying to... And we explain to referees, hey, they're not expecting you to change the decision that you just made, but they want to influence your decision making from there on. That's just unfortunately the nature of our sport. I often say to referees, there's not a lot of sports in the world where you actually have to deal with players, coaches and spectators in such a confined space. And I can't think of too many other sports where every time a referee has to make a decision, they just have to justify it, often not only to a player, but also to the coaches as they run up and down the sideline. That, you know, the other point that we make to referees is to explain to the coach, hey, listen, coach, you're distracting me. You think I'm doing a bad job now. If you keep asking me questions and distracting me, I'm going to do worse than I'm actually doing now. You know, so they need to concentrate and they need to focus on what they're trying to do. There's no question that they make errors. And when we're covering, you know, we're talking about that number of referees, it's a very difficult expectation to have that all of our referees are going to have these great communication skills and ability to deal with people.
Yep. And it is hard. And, you know, I've certainly been guilty of it in the past. I know I refereed as I was a junior coming on through. I was always one of the ones that would say, yeah, I may have screwed that call up. And it's probably you can get away with that once, maybe twice. And after the third time you say that, it's like, hey, you know what? You're getting paid to do this. You better start getting this right.
Well, I had an example of that many years ago when Phil Smythe, I sort of made a mistake of this. So then the very next call he makes comes up and asks me, do you want to change that call again, Billy? Because you've just, you know, made a mistake the first time. So you can't win.
No, absolutely right. And look, it certainly does help. I really do believe that it does help when you have a good working relationship with the referees and the coaches. And that might just be a chat before the game. Hey, how are you going? You've been doing this long. Was the last game you refed a good one? All those sorts of things. But when you can have an open dialogue with the referees, it's much easier.
Absolutely. I use as a really good point to our referees as well. And I gave the example of Coach K at the Olympic Games. I was sitting on the bench as a commissioner, and he would come up and ask me the names of all three referees. So then... he'd go away and sort of prior to the game sort of commencing, he'd come up and he'd call all three referees by their name. He would sort of have a little chat to them and sort of be very polite and very... and the referees would walk away thinking, you know, what a great guy this was, he was as well. But he did his sort of homework prior to it. You know, he also used to get his team manager to find out a little bit of the detail, how many games they'd done and all that sort of stuff. So I thought that's a really professional approach to, you know, to dealing with... And one thing we say to our referees as well, that we want them to go and speak to the coach at the beginning of the game, just to introduce themselves. Don't get involved in conversations about how you're going to call the game or whatever, because immediately you say that and you don't follow that through, then you're in trouble. But I remember speaking with a baseball coach, and they said, baseball referee, and they said the same thing, because they go up and speak to the managers first off. And he said, because generally, if you don't do that, the next time you speak to the manager is when they're angry and arguing with you. And so they want to start off on the right foot to begin with. Makes sense. I think the analogy is pretty good for us as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's a great way to be. And also, as coaches, we need to be understanding that our behaviour will reflect on the players. If we're up and about and we're into the rest, well, our players certainly do it. And I know I'm coaching 12s at the moment, and I had a swipe in one of my games about, hey, that's travel, and... listening to the rules, I was probably wrong in fairness, but all of a sudden my little 9-year-old kid says, oh, that's a travel too. And it's like, well, actually they're sort of imprinting the behaviour that I've shown as well.
And particularly in VJBL, it's not only also the players, but it's the parents as well that really sort of react. And the biggest issue I find for our referees in VJBL is dealing with the parents and the comments that are made on the sideline, which they don't have a great deal of control over.
Yep.
And so it's a tough gig for them. And then not only that, if you think about it, the parents are getting into them. The coach is starting getting into them. You know, yep. then their responses are
nowhere
often.
Left to hide.
Absolutely.
No, exactly right. Well, thanks for joining us, Bill. I would encourage everyone to go and check out the new rules, especially with the travel in particular, because that's probably the one we're going to see the most of, I'd suggest, early on. Please do go check out the rules, which are on the VTOC website. So you can get those through the Basketball Victoria webpage link. And they've been on social media as well. So please do go and check them out. If we can help to educate our coaches, we'll hopefully it will flow onto the players and we'll have players dunking off three steps from half court in no time. And, you know, everything will be a lot easier for us.
And if they're smart referees, they don't call it.
Exactly right, especially if they've gone cross-court on it. Thanks for joining us, Bill, and good luck, everyone, with your coaching.